want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. America's failed experiment with mass incarceration appears to be winding down, or at least easing to some extent. Moves by the president, by members of Congress to change sentencing laws, and to try to reduce the use of incarceration are gaining ground. But we still have today 2.5 million Americans, one of the largest per capita prison populations in the world. And today I'm talking with James Kilgore, whose powerful new book describes the complex issues in great detail but a very accessible way. His book is called Understanding Mass Incarceration. And James Kilgore has first-person experience, as he'll explain. He's done time in federal and state prisons, and toward the end of the interview, we'll describe why he went to prison. And you'll say, oh, yeah, I remember that group. Before we get to James Kilgore, allow me to thank people who subscribe to our podcast and support my work. People like Cheryl Fleming, Faith Peoples, Terry Paris, and Dick Atlee. They're subscribers one and all, and I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Up in the upper right corner, you click on Menu. Next, you click on Become a Subscriber. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution. And you can also go to the Apple App Store and buy our Peter B. Collins app for just $2.99. It's good on iPhones and iPads. America appears to be coming out of a 40-year bout with prison blues. This is Jimmy Page opening the podcast today.
I've been a bad boy all night long. Ooh, yes I have, baby. Yes, I've been a bad boy.
There's a powerful new book about mass incarceration in the United States of America. And it's a book that I found very informative and extremely accessible. It's not an academic approach. It's a people's guide to the key civil rights struggle of our time. Author James Kilgore joins us today. James, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Peter. It's good to be with you.
And your book is something, this is a subject that I care a whole lot about and that I've been passionate about for many, many years. As a teenager, one of my brothers was falsely accused of a crime, and it really opened my eyes to the failings of our criminal justice system. And later in life, I got involved with a nonprofit group at San Quentin Prison. And I've learned a lot about the failings of the system. I've met a lot of people behind bars. And you have captured these key issues in a way that is extremely readable. And you bring a lot of powerful information to a topic that, fortunately, is getting more attention now than it has in many, many decades.
No, absolutely. We're seeing, well, I mean, we've seen the Pope visiting people in prison. We've seen the President visiting people in prison and so forth. So mass incarceration and the criminal justice system more broadly are topics of discussion in the presidential debate. And if we look back at 2012, it wasn't even a footnote to what was happening. So we've really seen some changes in the kind of public awareness, which is an important step in trying to make some change happen. But it's of course not the final step. It's the early stages.
Yeah. No, but frankly, just to see attitudes ease about the demonization of people who break the law and the kind of, couch potato judgment that people engage in, where, you know, let's just take the Trayvon Martin case, okay? When that splashed into the national media, people immediately took very hardline judgments, and they said, here's an innocent kid. And other people looked at the shooter, Zimmerman, and, were defending him, and nobody had any real information about it. But people seem very comfortable based on a snippet that they see on television news or even in a dramatic show on TV to make really deep judgments and decide that someone's life is disposable.
Yes, well, I mean, I think one of the things that's happened, you know, over the course of the last, really the period since Trayvon Martin's death, is we've seen a lot of social media exposing some of the police abuse, at least. And that has raised some questions about the kind of information that we've been getting from mainstream media all along about the whole question of mass incarceration and the tough on crime and how we've really seen the local news, for example, shift dramatically in content where, we have this if it bleeds, it leads kind of situation. We're constantly being subjected to tales of crime, as the sort of norm, as if it's been unchanging. Yet we're now nationally we're at a low ebb in crime statistics since lower than any period in the last 20 years. But you wouldn't know it the way in which it's portrayed in the media until we've seen these videos that a lot of people have taken that have been posted to YouTube and really have called into question some of the policing practices and also the way in which media has been covering these events.
Very well said there, James, because I've actually tracked this, that since about 2000, we've seen violent crime dropping in most categories across the United States. But the actual coverage of the reduction in crime left the impression with most people that the rates were unchanged or actually increasing, and it leads people to hunker down in their homes and buy more guns.
And it also fuels the continued expansion of prison and jail building and the continued growth of corrections budgets. So even though the U.S. crime levels are pretty much parallel to most European countries now, we find that the U.S. incarceration rate is 4 to 10 times greater than any industrialized Western European country.
And James, your book is really comprehensive, and I went through it very carefully. And I'm just so impressed by, every aspect that you cover. And let me start at the very darkest, deepest dungeons in America today. And those are these privately run or corporate run detention facilities where immigrants or people facing deportation are held. And these are completely black holes. I've interviewed former guards who worked at these facilities in Arizona and Texas, and they routinely engage in sexual encounters with female prisoners. They manipulate the inmates. They extort them. And these are people who are held in the United States, but they have no rights. And they are even generally denied habeas corpus get into any kind of a legal proceeding. And most Americans are oblivious.
No, that's absolutely correct. And, I mean, I've tried to point out in the book that, in my opinion, this sort of war on immigrants is kind of a second phase of mass incarceration. And these things are often not connected. The first phase being the war on drugs, which was largely directed at African-American communities. But if we look at the statistics for people in prison since the year 2000, we actually find that the absolute number of African-Americans in prisons has gone down by about 12%, whereas the percentage of Hispanics, as they're called in federal statistics, has grown by more than 50%. And we've also seen the immigration detention and the immigration prisons, and there's also a separate set of prisons that have been built for so-called criminal aliens, apart from the immigration detention centers, which deal mainly with people involved in immigration. Right. These have given an opportunity for a resurgence of private prisons, which haven't really been successful in gaining much of a foothold beyond immigration.
Well, and the private operation of prisons, I think, is you know, fundamentally flawed. Because when you put the profit motive into the operation of a facility like this, it will inevitably lead to corners being cut in health care, in what the quality of food is. And, you know, nobody ever claims that prison food is good, but it can be really bad. They cut corners on hiring and screening the people who work as guards at these facilities. And it's just a recipe for disaster, and nobody cares. And the media rarely covers the grisly events that I believe are occurring almost daily.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. There's something fundamentally flawed about the notion of a private prison and about the notion of the two major private prison corporations, the GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America, are publicly traded companies, so people buy shares in this, so their accountability becomes to the shareholders, you know, rather than to the community or to the taxpayers, let alone to the people they've incarcerated. But I think it's also important to realize that sometimes people who are really adamant about opposing mass incarceration and the tough on crime philosophy probably pay a little bit too much attention to the private prison corporations, because they really only control about 8.4% of the prison beds nationally. And really, if we think of many of the horror stories of prisons across the country, in places like Pelican Bay SHU, for example, mm-hmm. where we've seen the hunger strikes, or Angola, Louisiana, or in my state, TAMS, which was a solitary confinement facility, which was only closed down in the last year and a half.
That's,
I mean,
in
these
Illinois,
are all state-run,
by the way,
institutions, and this has largely been a state and government-driven project, and with the private prison corporations benefiting from it, but not really actually being the main drivers of the project. It's a political project with a lot of political motives and profits for a lot of corporations, even beyond the private prisons.
Well, that's a very good context to provide. I appreciate that. James, you also focus on the dramatic increase of the number of women in prison. And you note, for example, the female jail population. Well, let me start with the prisons. The number of people in state and federal women's prisons increased by 600% from 1977 to 2011, from 15,000 to 111,000. And then when we look at jails, usually operated at the county or city level, the female jail population also increased. In 1986, female jails held 7% of the total, about 22,000. And by 2013, the figures had jumped to 14%, and 102,000 is the estimated population. And this is something, again, that is mostly off the charts for most Americans.
Completely off the charts. I think we tend to think of the people who are locked up as universally male, number one. And number two, we also tend to think of men as the people who are impacted by mass incarceration. But women have been affected by mass incarceration in many ways in parallel to what's happened to men. So not only have we seen this increase in the number of women who are incarcerated, but we're also finding that women who are left behind in the disproportionately poor and African American and Latino communities where most people in the prison population come from, they are left with financial responsibilities, with parenting responsibilities, with the responsibility of trying to hold the community together. And all of this has happened in a situation where their economic situation has actually been deteriorating. So if we look at what's happened in terms of public benefits since the early 1980s, we find things like public housing, food stamps, other kinds of public benefits, and employment opportunities have become much harder to access. So this has been a real gendered impact of mass incarceration. And once again, the impact on women is often invisible, as you pointed out.
And James, to build on that, you write very persuasively about the criminalization of poverty. And we also saw that the working poor, and this was exposed in Ferguson in a very serious way, but the working poor end up getting hit with fines and traffic tickets and things that they can't pay, and then they'll often spend jail time because of a non-criminal event. And for example, just recently, Governor Brown here in California signed a bill that is they are hoping will reduce the number of people driving on suspended licenses by not requiring you to pay the bail amount or the ticket amount before you go to court to challenge a ticket that's been issued. There are more than 4 million people in California with suspended licenses, and those aren't all working poor, but many of them are. And in Ferguson, we saw that this white-dominated city government in a predominantly African-American community was getting I think as much as 50% of its budget extracted from the wallets of poor people in the community.
That's right, and Ferguson is not the exception, and this is a phenomenon that's been going on across the country. I'm glad to see that California is taking some steps to resolve part of the problem. I mean, one of the things that's happened is that people are getting their driver's license suspended for offenses that have nothing to do with driving. So we have people who are racking up fines for violating municipal ordinances. So, for example, when you talk about the criminalization of poverty, we've seen ordinances across the country basically outlawing the survival activities of the poor and especially the homeless. So, for example, we have about a third of the cities in a major study across the country. A third of the cities had ordinances against sleeping in public or even lying down in public. Almost half of these cities had ordinances that prohibited begging in public places or things that are called aggressive panhandling. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't see the Koch brothers doing any aggressive panhandling, at least not on the streets. So this is really targeted at poor people. They get a fine for panhandling that they can't pay because obviously if they had money, they wouldn't be panhandling. But then they get their driver's license suspended for that, and then they drive when they have their driver's license because they need it to do their daily life activities, and then they get pulled over. And we have this whole incredible cycle, which I think Ferguson brought out something which is happening in many municipalities across the country. And this is locally based, really done at the city and county level, not at the state and federal level.
So let's talk a little bit about jails in general, because you can, on almost any given day, find a news account of something that occurred in a jail where it was not a wrongdoing on the part of an inmate, but, the L.A. County Sheriff's Department is embroiled in a series of scandals where deputies staged fights between inmates. That's also occurred in the San Francisco jail. And there are a lot of things that go on in county jails that never receive any scrutiny. And the individuals who are wronged by a guard or, mistreated or brutalized have very little recourse. And, if you go to your local newspaper and say the sheriff's deputies beat me up, their general reaction is, well, you probably deserved it. What's new?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I think one of the things that a lot of people don't recognize is how important jails are to this system of mass incarceration. So
that's where most of the prisoners
are. We might have about 700,000 or a third of the total incarcerated population in jails in the course of a year, because people tend to stay in jail for short periods of time. We have somewhere around 11 million admissions into jails. So these are major cogs in the wheel of mass incarceration. They're the first step for people who end up going to prison, but they also are the first step for people who get in that debt cycle that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. And they're also they've also become a major drain on municipal and county budgets, because in many places the jail is the major capital expense, you know, drawing on property taxes and other local tax revenues. So they really are an important piece in this whole puzzle of mass incarceration. And as you point out, they tend to be much less regulated even than prisons. And I know from my own experience that just about anyone would rather be doing time in a state prison than in a local jail, simply because the conditions in those jails are so horrific.
And you published a very easy to read chart in your book. And let me just recap this for people in ascending order. There are 216,000 people held in federal prisons. There are 721,000 on an average day held in local jails, but the vast majority of those, 428,000, are people who are being held who can't post bail, or the case doesn't permit them to post bail, and they are awaiting trial. The breakdown is 428,000 waiting for trial and just under 300,000 who are actually serving a sentence in a local jail. And then state prisons have the bulk of our incarcerated population, about 1.3 million. I'm looking for the date here. I think it's
2010 or 2011.
Right? Yeah, I think that's right. So that gives people a snapshot. And when we look at the scandals that have surfaced from Rikers Island, most of those relate to people who were unable to post bail and who languished there for months, sometimes even years, awaiting trial.
Absolutely. And one of the phenomena that's happened over the course of the period of mass incarceration is we've gradually seen bail charges go up and up and up, making it more and more difficult for people to actually post bail. And this has been, at least to some extent, the result of a concerted effort by the American Bail Coalition, which is kind of a coalition of private bail bonding companies who obviously make more money the greater the bail is. So this has made it progressively more and more difficult for people to get out on bail. The use of, you know, own recognizance, that is, get out without having to pay bail, has decreased, and this has disproportionately affected, you know, poor African American and Latino people who end up sitting in jail for months on end, you know, awaiting some kind of adjudication in their case. And that jail is that bail issue also becomes important in terms of applying the pressure on people to accept a plea bargain, because if they can't get bailed out of jail, then they want to get the case over with and either get out or get to a prison where it's better in terms of conditions. So it puts a lot of pressure on them to accept plea deals rather than take their case to trial and end up spending more time in jail.
And James, next, let's focus on the state prisons. And as you point out, you know, many people who've served time certainly felt that they were better treated and conditions were superior in a relative way.
In
state prisons. Still, every state has a sorry legacy of abuses of prisoners, of wrongdoing by guards and administrators. It's really an ugly patchwork of inconsistent standards across the country, but very few are standards that we can be proud of.
Absolutely. And I think, there's two things I'd like to say on that. The first is that the notion of rehabilitation has almost disappeared from our state prison systems. I mean, it used to be there was extensive education programs, job training and so forth, that really there was this fundamental belief that people should be given a second chance and that programs in prison should give them those opportunities. But that's essentially been eliminated or greatly reduced in almost all places. So, for example, the last prison I was in, which was High Desert State Prison in California, we had a motor mechanics training workshop. We had an institutional kitchen to train institutional cooks, and we had a nursery to train people in horticulture, and none of those were operating. They were all closed down despite millions of dollars being spent to build them up. So
James,
is very little going on. People are being warehoused and not really being given opportunities that will lead them to success when they're on the streets. The second point, which is particular to California, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit more, is the incredible racial segregation in California state prisons in particular, where the prison administration goes along with a program of segregating people by race. So you have black showers and white showers. You have black phones and white phones. And the rules don't allow blacks and whites or blacks and Latinos to share a cell. The administration decides who's in what cell, and you can't share a cell with someone of a different race. This is in force in medium and high security prisons.
Those are both very important points. Let me address the rehabilitation point, because at the time, I believe you were serving in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the action movie star, was playing governor. And he changed the name. It had been simply the California Department of Corrections. And he said, no, we're going to call it the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And then in the next 2 years, he cut program spending of any meaningful type of rehabilitation, even as the overcrowding expanded to the point that a federal court intervened and ordered California to sharply reduce its inmate population.
Well, I noticed one big change when the rehabilitation was added to the department's name, and that is that we all got different pants and different shirts that, instead of saying CDC prisoner on the leg and on the back, they said CDCR prisoner on the leg and on the back. That was the change that I think everybody noticed. The rest of it, the rehabilitation part, didn't happen, but they made sure that they got our uniforms changed.
And let's pursue this for another minute, because what most people who accept the kind of simple messages that come from TV news and TV programs and movies is the idea that people need to be punished, that is the best way of preventing them from reoffending. But we know that that doesn't really work, and we know that the vast majority of people who are behind bars today will someday be back on the street, back in their communities. And it is so short-sighted to pretend that punishment is going to make them a better people. Punishment is going to prevent them from returning to prison.
I think that's absolutely true, Peter, and I think it's the central thing that we need to change about this system. We can talk about changing laws, we can talk about changing policies, but the fundamental point here is that we've seen a massive change in mindset, which I think really kicked off with Reagan's war on drugs, although there were roots of it before that. But this notion of punishing people rather than giving them second chances, this notion of being vindictive rather than being merciful. And I think there's a great book by a man named Brian Stevenson called Just Mercy, where he talks a lot about cases where people have wrongfully been convicted of capital offenses and either sent to death or he's helped them to escape the execution. But it really talks about how the notion of mercy has almost completely disappeared disappeared from the criminal justice system and from the population more broadly. We've become quite vindictive and quite punitive, I think, in the popular consciousness. And I mean, this needs to be reversed in the same way that it was changed from the 60s and 70s to this tough on crime, you know, call in the police kind of approach to solving problems, rather than let's sit down and build a community that can communicate with each other and talk about problems and collectively come up with ways to solve them, rather than the minute there's some harm done, let's lock somebody up, and the longer they're locked up, the better.
And James, I want to follow up on what you were talking about a moment ago about segregation, because it is simply obscene that, you know, we have laws for the general population that sanction any actions that relate to segregation or racial discrimination. And we now have a new law in California to try to clamp down on racial profiling by police officers, and I support that. But inside the prisons, segregation by race and by gang is commonplace across the country, and nobody bats an eye about it, or even, you know, takes a second look and says, "Well, wait a minute, didn't we outlaw segregation?"
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's two things. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that California has had a uniquely pernicious system of racial segregation. There is no other state that had institutionalized segregation that was both enforced by the administration and completely adopted by the prison population as well, to the point where myself, being white and being in that prison population, I mean, I was banned not by the administration, but by the other white members of the population from doing things like sharing food with a black person. So if I did that, I was going to be beaten up or stabbed. I'm not saying I never did it, but I couldn't just go out and do it in the middle of the yard in the public eye without suffering the repercussions of that. And that whole system has been actively supported by the prison administration because it allows them to divide and conquer the population and control the population much more effectively than they could when people were able to communicate and work together. So that's really a uniquely California experience. But I think it's definitely correct to say that prisons in general across the country are breeding grounds for white supremacy, breeding grounds for other kinds of, you know, racial divisiveness. And I think we've seen, you know, we've seen people like this man Evan Ebel, who came out of a Colorado prison and who went and assassinated the former director of the Department of Corrections, you know, coming out of a white supremacist organization. We see these organizations in prisons everywhere: the skinheads, the dirty white boys, the Hell's Angels, the Aryan Brotherhood. They're across the country, and their gospel spills out into the streets, and it helps perpetuate and create people like Dylann Roof on the streets. Even though he hadn't been in prison, the mentality that he espoused very much reminded me of what happened to a lot of young white guys when they came into prison and were remolded by the white supremacy that was so omnipresent there.
Well, and James, prison officials rationalized the segregation based on the gangs that you just described, and, you know, I'd add the Muslim Brotherhood to it in certain institutions. But here's a snapshot for you. I recently interviewed John Kiriakou, who is the only CIA officer who was sent to prison over the torture program, and it was because he acknowledged that there was a torture program.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, he did 24 or 25 months at a minimum lockup, a federal place in Pennsylvania called Loretto. And he described how the TV room was controlled, and by the way, whites are a minority at that prison. He said that there was a black leader and a Latino leader, and they were the ones who controlled what was on the TV set in the recreation room. and that if he wanted to watch a program, he would have to go to one of those guys and trade him cigarettes or chewing gum or postage stamps in order to get to watch his show. And so even at these, you know, kind of non-sensitive levels of the operation of a prison, segregation is actively permitted.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, the federal places where I was in, Dublin, right there in the Bay Area, and then Lompoc, it is true that the TVs were racially controlled. I mean, and we had one television in Lompoc, for example, that was controlled by a group of senior mafia dons, right? So they watched what they wanted to watch. But I mean, I would have to say that despite that, in federal prisons, the dominance of white supremacy and the ability of people to interact across racial groups and so forth was much greater than in the California state prisons. I mean, I didn't have any boundaries in terms of who I could socialize with or who I could share a cell with in the federal system. But in the state, it was completely different.
Interesting. Also, we know that the prisons are the repository, the end of the line for many mentally ill people, and we have criminalized their health conditions, and we consign them to places where they get minimal, if any, psychological or psychiatric care. They might be fed some drugs to try to keep them under control, but we are locking up, I don't know what the percentage is, but a significant number of the people, particularly in state prison and in county jails, are there because they have mental health problems.
Absolutely, and I think this goes back to the point you raised before about the criminalization of poverty. So part of what's happened is we've seen the closure of state mental hospitals and the closure of other public facilities which deal with mental illness, so that what happens when police find somebody who's having a mental health crisis, who's acting out in a public space, the only alternative left for the police really is to take them to jail. And so we now find that the numbers of people in prisons and jails with mental health issues is at least 10 times the number in state mental hospitals. And of course, I mean, we can't really expect county sheriffs and local police to be mental health therapists. And I've never heard any therapist recommend a short stint or a long stint of incarceration as a cure. So it really is perpetuating and accentuating, you know, those mental illnesses. And you're absolutely right in terms of the kinds of therapy that most people get. They get pills thrown at them. And that's really all about control, but not about therapy.
I want to ask you, do you watch John Oliver's show on HBO on Sunday nights?
I do watch it some of the time, yes.
Because I give him a lot of credit. He's a British guy.
Yeah, I know. He's amazing.
And yet he has covered asset forfeitures that you mentioned in the book. He's talked about the bail issues. He's talked about mass incarceration. And the way his show is structured, it's a half hour long, and he typically goes deep for about 12 or 15 minutes on one topic. And many of these criminal justice and incarceration issues that you highlight in the book are things that he's been covering on that show, which is just a little over a year old.
Yes, and I was also really pleased the other night to see that, you know, Trevor Noah, the successor to Jon Stewart, had a segment on Ban the Box and on the bans that are placed on people with felony convictions in terms of accessing employment. So he had a similar segment, about 12 to 15 minutes, where he actually went out and interviewed some people who had been formerly incarcerated and employers and things. And I thought it was very cleverly done and it was very humorous, in that sort of dark humor that John Oliver and Jon Stewart have made so popular.
James, there's so much in the book, and I can't touch on all of it in the short time that we have today, but I highly recommend it to people. And one of the elements that you do cover is the way that the families of prisoners are gouged with the collect phone calls that come from an institution where that very institution is skimming often 40% off the exorbitant rates that are charged by these murky phone companies that get the exclusive contract for phone calls from a given facility. It's really egregious extortion of the people who are least able to pay it.
Absolutely, and I've been involved in the National Campaign for Prison Phone Justice here in Illinois, and in Illinois, to make a phone call from a state prison, it costs $4, whether it's 1 minute or 15 minutes, and $3 of that money goes to the Illinois Department of Corrections. They made about $12 million last year off of these kickbacks, as we call them. That comes to over $140 million nationally. And Securus Technologies, one of the main phone providers in prisons, made $114 million off of these off of prison phone calls last year. But fortunately, the national campaign has actually been quite successful, enlisting the support of a number of families of people who are incarcerated as well as people behind bars. And we've succeeded in pressuring the Federal Communications Commission, and it looks as if on October 22nd, the Federal Communications Commission is going to make a ruling which will cap the permanent call charges at 11 cents a minute, which is a great relief for someone to be paying something on the order of $1.65 for a 15-minute phone call as opposed to the exorbitant rates. When I was in prison, my family was paying $1 a minute for phone calls.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ross Mercurimi, who's the sheriff in San Francisco, and he's hanging on to his job up for re-election in November, but he's a real progressive, and he has led the charge, and I believe they've now reduced it to 12 or 15 cents a minute for a collect call from the San Francisco County Jail. And we need to see law enforcement officials step up and recognize how egregious this is and mm-hmm. make it right. I mean, phone calls are free to, negligible in cost these days. And, even hotels have given up trying to extort money from their customers over phone calls. James, in your book, you talk about efforts to reduce the prison population, both by reducing the number of people flowing in and by increasing the number of people flowing out. And one element that you touch on is called restorative justice, and you also talk about transformative justice. And these are essentially victim-offender reconciliation programs. And I have a friend, Lisa Ray, who runs a nonprofit called Restorative Justice International. And she's been a leader in developing these programs in prison. And we've even seen it now filtering down to the high school level, where instead of suspending truants or other people who step out of line, they work on these more appropriate processes. What's your take on the proper role of these restorative justice efforts in prison and in as part of the parole process?
Well, I think I really have a lot of belief in restorative justice as a preventative, as a way to address harm when it happens in a community before we resort to locking people up and putting them in the criminal justice system. So I think it's a very good antidote to the school-to-prison pipeline, for example, that when we have conflict in schools, this restorative justice model where people communicate with each other and someone who does the harm is made to understand that harm has implications for other people and try to think of doing things in different ways and restore whatever relationships existed before the harm was done. I'm a little less optimistic about how that might work in prisons, simply because it's difficult to build up an environment of trust in an institution where there's so much mistrust and so much use of information against people for various reasons. But I think restorative justice in the framework of a transformative justice model is very, very positive. Transformative justice meaning that, yes, we need to restore those individual relationships and try to undo the harm or learn from the harm, but the transformative piece comes in to say that there are structural reasons why we have mass incarceration, and that these have a lot to do with the communities that have been hardest hit by mass incarceration. So we have a lack of public housing, a lack of employment opportunities, general poverty and inequality, and along with the restorative practices that is moving away from punishment, we also need to be reallocating resources into these communities so that people have opportunities and crime or doing harm won't be kind of the path of least resistance.
We also need to take a hard look at the parole process because it's a broken system, and we see the high rates of recidivism, reincarceration. And that is a subject that we could discuss in a whole podcast sometime. James, I also want to mention that just over dinner last night, my friend Mark Lewis mentioned that he has a friend who runs a business in San Francisco. And I'm going to put up a link in the show file for this podcast so people can take a look at their website. It's called Social Imprints, and they make T-shirts and other, logo imprinted items. And 80% of their workforce are from at-risk populations, including ex-cons. And it's a business, I believe, that was started by a guy who did some time. And these are the kinds of, progressive approaches to reducing the rate of reoffending that we need to embrace across the country. Because, when you get out of San Quentin, they give you $200 and they drive you to the bus stop in San Rafael and wish you well. and that is not going to be effective for most of the people who are left stripped of resources, separated from family, and impoverished by their stretch in prison.
That's absolutely totally true. In Illinois, they give you $10, so I was better off because I got paroled from California. But I think the point you're making is that employers need to be opening their eyes to the possibility of hiring someone with a felony conviction, get rid of this stigma, understand that people do change, understand that people do have potential. I mean, I work in a reentry program in the community where I work and we've been talking with a number of employers. We also have a Ban the Box initiative in Illinois and in our local city, which bans employers from putting the question about criminal background onto the job application. And this has been an important mobilizing point for people across the country around these issues. But there really is a shift in the mentality about people with felony convictions, and I think we need to keep promoting that, because after all, just because you made a mistake, just because you have a felony conviction, doesn't somehow mean that you no longer should be considered a full citizen or a full human being. And that's part of why I've called the book The Struggle for Civil Rights, because in 2012, almost 6,000 people weren't allowed to vote because they had a felony conviction. So we're fighting for civil rights, full access to voting, full access to employment, full access to other kinds of state benefits. And that's an important way to think of this, I think, as we move ahead.
James, I'm sure listeners have picked up your multiple references to the jail time or the prison time that you've done at the state and federal level. And I chose not to open with that because I wanted people to hear the information and hear the work that you've done in this very important book. But I think that people do deserve an explanation that you were a member or involved with the Symbionese Liberation Army back in the 1970s. You left the country and were on the run, or at least beyond the reach of the United States for 27 years, spent most of that time in South Africa. You picked up a PhD in Australia along the way. And then in 2002, things caught up with you and you came back to the United States and took a plea, which led to your stretches in prison. I just want to say that I'm really impressed with the person you are. And it's not that important to me what happened in the 1970s. I have a few things that I'm not so proud of from the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But tell our listeners what your experience as a prisoner taught you and what motivated you. You've published three novels, and you've also written this brand-new book.
Well, I think my experience as a prisoner, I came into the system, really I was out of the country, as you pointed out, for a long period of time. I really didn't have any idea what was going on in this criminal justice system in the United States. I was pretty well detached from that. I'd been an educator in South Africa. I'd done a lot of education work for trade unions and other community organizations. So when I got into the prison system in the U.S., I could see that there seemed to be an endless stream of bodies coming through the gates, disproportionately black and brown, and lots of poor whites as well. And I could see something was really wrong, but I didn't even by the time I left prison in 2009, I didn't have this idea of mass incarceration in my head. I didn't even have that vocabulary. But I was determined to find out kind of what was going on and try to do something about it, because I could just see that people's lives were being wasted. My friends were getting 30, 40, 50. I had one friend that had 555 years as a sentence, and I could just see that there was no connection between that and really the seriousness of most of their crimes. So I became involved trying to research this, and I tried to use my experience of writing popular education materials in Southern Africa to inform the way in which I wrote about way I wrote about it in the book. So that's kind of why I came to write about this. I don't think I would have ever written anything about mass incarceration if I hadn't been locked up, but I also think it's important that I have that perspective, the sort of insider-outsider perspective as I write about this. But I'm also concerned that I don't want to write about my story. I want to write about the story of the 2.2 million people who are locked up, the 4.7 million people who are on parole or probation, and their, you know, their families and communities.
Well, you've done that very effectively, and I commend you for it. Explain to our listeners your recent difficulties with your employer, the University of Illinois, which has also been brutal towards Stephen Salita, or Salita. I'm not sure exactly how his name is pronounced. But he, you know, was drummed out for exercising his free speech rights in support of the Palestinians. And you were working on a contract basis, as I understand it. And when it was time for renewal, all of a sudden, they decided they didn't want an ex-con.
Well, I mean, what actually happened is that when I came to the community I started working at the university in 2011, as you pointed out, on a contract basis, even as an academic hourly. And I worked for up until early 2014, really without incident. Every time I had several contracts with different departments, but each and every time I was employed, I fully disclosed my criminal background, the whole political history that you've outlined. I showed people articles. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to in any way deceive people or have them be ambushed by my background later on. So what happened is that in February of 2014, the local sort of right-wing newspaper ran a four-page spread on me in their Sunday edition, you know, detailing all of my background and so forth, as if he called it hiding in plain sight, as if I was hiding anything, and the writer was sort of demanding that I be fired from the university. So what ultimately happened is that the chairperson of the Board of Trustees, Chris Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy's son, issued an order for me to be, for any future contracts of mine to be chopped. And so that's what happened. But in order to kind of assuage the faculty, because 300 faculty signed a petition in support of my reinstatement, they formed a committee to investigate my employment. And the committee found that I had done nothing illicit whatever, and that I should be rehired. So they ended up rehiring me because they couldn't afford to alienate the faculty any further, because they'd already alienated them a lot by denying the appointment of Stephen Salita, who you mentioned before.
Mm-hmm. And James, I haven't done deep research on your situation, but what I did pick up from browsing on the internet is that in this exchange where you were fighting for your job and you were being demonized, they tagged you using the term terrorist. And
sure.
Back in the 1970s, I don't believe anybody referred to the actions of the SLA as terrorism. It was considered criminal, and you were described as revolutionaries or counterculture. But we didn't use that term, and it seems that they kind of retroactively applied it to you for the purpose of a contemporary effort to make you look bad and deny you employment.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure no one used that term in the 1970s, but certainly it has had a completely different meaning in the U.S. since 9/11. So, you know, that's why we even have people who are labeled terrorists, making terrorist threats. If you threaten to punch somebody in the nose, you can end up with a terrorist threat charge. So it's come to have a very sinister kind of meaning and apply to a much broader category of activity.
Mm-hmm. I have one more kind of minor question for you, and that is last summer at a picnic that was hosted by one of my friends who's an ex-prisoner, I met Bill Harris for the first time. And I just wonder if you are permitted to be in contact, you know, based on the plea deal that you took. And if so, are you in contact? Do you want to be? Is there any lingering connection between people who were involved with the SLA?
We're not prohibited from communicating. We don't really connect much. I don't think there's any particular animosity. I think we've all just kind of decided that we'll go on with our lives and leave that episode behind.
All right. Well, James, real pleasure to meet you, and thanks for talking with us today. I highly recommend your book. It's Understanding Mass Incarceration, subtitled A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. And it's out now from the New Press. Should be available at your local bookstore or online. James Kilgore, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Are you ready to end mass incarceration? I sure am. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.